Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue where we left off last week. We were talking about the economic effects of Trump, which aren't fully revealed yet. It's a work in progress, you might say, but some of the outlines are beginning to appear more clearly. A lot will depend on who these appointments are, and if we have time, we'll talk, make some comments on the Trump appointments. You know, he's appointed this guy, General Flynn here, for his foreign policy, and that requires some analysis. What does that mean for attitudes towards Russia and China and so forth, Middle East, ISIS, et cetera, as his national security advisor, key role. And it looks like Jeff Sessions here is going to be the Attorney General, not Giuliani. So the key on these appointments, we'll get back to them, but the key on these appointments are, is he moving back towards the mainstream here, the Republican mainstream in these appointments, or is his more radical populist measures that he raised during the election going to prevail? I believe that what we're going to see is on those issues that are of great importance to corporate America, economic issues, it will look more like mainstream Republican trends over the last decades here. It will continue to be neoliberal, while he focuses more on the non-economic issues to appeal to his populist right base, like immigration, okay, and Obamacare. He'll try to hold that base together with those more radical proposals while pushing through big benefits for corporate America, as Republicans have always planned to do and proposed to do. In some ways, one more comment on this before we get to the main theme today. In some ways, what we've got, I'm going to predict, is a kind of a mirror right image of Obama in 2008. In other words, Obama in 2008 acted like a left populist. Excuse me. I have a little bit of under the weather here. But when he got into office, of course, he appointed mainstream corporate people, and his old administration reflected that. So it was a lot of populist talk to the people who fell for the propaganda. But then he governed from a corporate perspective. And I think what we got in Trump here is a mirror image on the right. We have a full populist right, populist kind of a campaign, and what we see in actual policies and programs will probably be something very similar to a mainstream Republican, you know, particularly on matters of taxes and trade and regulation. That's mainstream Republican neoliberalism, and we're going to see more of that, I think. But a lot depends on the appointments, and they are still being made here, which reflects, if you look at the appointments, Attorney General and NSA and their foreign policy appointments are coming out first, which means that there is great tension in the Trump camp right now over who really gets appointed, what types really get appointed to these key positions like the U.S. Treasury. And there is a kind of a internecine struggle going on within the Trump preparation teams here as to who is going to get appointed to these key positions, you know, the traditional establishment Republicans, establishment types, or the more radical outside types. I believe that the establishment types are beginning to win out here, but we will see in some of these positions that are appointed. If I have time, I'm going to also talk about Trump in historical perspective. There's a lot of similarities here, I believe, between Trump, particularly on the economic side, with Reagan and with Nixon before him on the foreign policy side and domestic non-economic policy. Nixon, foreign policy, domestic non-economic policy, Reagan, economic policy. You know, everything changes, nothing changes in American politics so long as these two parties continue to dominate everything. They just keep tricking the people time and time again. Okay, so let's move on here. And, excuse my my sniffling here. But let's move on and pick up where we left last week. Last week I talked, gave my view a little bit on Trumponomics. I wouldn't say Trump 1.0. I would say Trump 0.5. In other words, what his initial economic programs are just beginning to emerge. We can get some signals. But the impacts are already beginning to emerge. In other words, businesses and capitalists globally are making assumptions of what they think is going to emerge here. And they are acting already. We're having major new trends and developments in the global economy beginning to emerge as a result of just his electoral victory here. And we need to discuss some of those, not just domestic, which I addressed a little bit last week, and I'm sure we will continue to talk about in weeks to come, focusing in particular on fiscal and monetary policy. On the fiscal side, of course, the emphasis looks like it's coming is fiscal stimulus focused on infrastructure spending, you know, building roads and infrastructure and other infrastructure, bridges, et cetera, airports, you know, upgrading airports and seaports and all kinds of things, infrastructure. That infrastructure spending, by the way, will not be government investment. It will be passing the money on to private interests who will give you less bang for the buck because they'll take a big corporate skimming in terms of profits off of all this. So infrastructure spending, fiscal policies, infrastructure spending, fiscal policy as tax cuts, big tax cuts coming for corporations and investors. In other words, a repeat of George W. Bush 2001-3 and Ronald Reagan in his first term. Traditional Republican, neoliberal Republican policies here, big corporate tax cuts. Well, you know, the infrastructure spending is going to require some budget expenditures by the government. And the tax cuts, of course, will also affect the budget. So you're going to have a bigger deficits and a bigger debt. At the same time, the cost of financing that debt is going to rise because interest rates are already rising. And when you talk about interest rates, you've got to talk about long-term rates and short-term rates. All this hullabaloo about the Federal Reserve is only about short-term rates, right? The Fed does not control long-term rates. General economic conditions drive long-term rates, like 30-year bonds and so forth, right? There is a relationship between them. However, long-term rates rising can draw up short-term rates, which is what we're seeing happening here, and or rising short-term rates can raise long-term rates. So there's a feedback effect between long and short-term rates. But we are seeing both rising. Long-term rates already rising significantly. And we'll talk about the relationship to the dollar to those driving up of those long-term rates. But the Federal Reserve is definitely 100% going to raise rates in December. And I believe that's only the beginning. They're going to continue raising rates, at first very cautiously, in early 2017. That's coming. 100% chance. Short-term rates going up, right? And more coming in 2017. But long-term rates are already rising. Now, why are they rising? And what are the consequences of long-term rates rising? Oh, they're significant in many dimensions. First of all, the dollar is rising. And the dollar, rising value of the dollar, dries up long-term rates. And in turn, long-term rates drive up the dollar. So that's going to continue. Dollar rising, long-term rates rising. This is the initial global effect of the Trump victory. And significant, we're going to see shortly why it's significant on the global economy and in turn and feedback effect on the U.S. economy. Okay, long-term rates rise when the dollar rises. There is also a relationship between the dollar and the inverse relationship, the dollar and oil prices, global oil prices. As the dollar rises, global oil prices tend to decline. Okay, so the dollar is rising, and we're already seeing oil prices declining. They were up in the low $50 per barrel. They're now back in the mid-40s, and they're slowly drifting further down. Okay. Now, what is the importance? What is the importance of oil price declines here? Well, oil, and why is the oil inversely related to the value of the dollar, right? We've seen the relationship between long-term rates and the dollar, right? When dollar goes up, long-term rates go up. Now, there's a second relationship here between dollar and, but it's inverse, long-term rates, oil prices decline as the value of the dollar rises. Well, why is that? I mean, oil is a commodity, right? I mean, what does that have to do with the dollar, which is a currency? Well, a lot, because oil is not just a commodity. Oil is a financial security. Oil commodity futures trading is what drives oil prices in the short term. And we see a lot of volatility of oil in the short term, don't we? Well, that's because it's a financial security. The overall supply and demand for oil does not change that rapidly. Oil supply and demand does not really drive oil prices in the short run. It's the speculation in oil futures that drive it up and down in the short run. Speculators will sell oil and buy dollars, which will lower the demand for oil, right, and reduce the price of oil at the same time raising the demand, because you're going to buy dollars, raising the value of dollars. So that's how it moves inversely. Ever since the late 1990s, when we've made oil a not just a commodity, but a financial security in the Oil Commodities Trading Act, we have a bonanza for speculators. And they buy and sell this stuff just as they buy and sell securities. And, if the dollar is going up, money is moving out of oil futures and it's moving into dollars. Now, overlaid on this is a long-term effect going on between the OPEC Saudis and U.S. frackers and Russia in the middle of this. If you look at who controls the supply of oil, it's not just OPEC and the Saudis. Russia produces as much supply of oil, and the U.S. does, as the Saudi does. You know, give or take a billion barrels, whatever. Three big players. So Saudi Arabia and their friends and OPEC no longer can control the price of oil the way they used to, right? It's a competition between the three. Russia needs the currency, so it's not going to agree to restrict the supply to drive the price back up of global crude. And U.S. frackers are not going to do it either. the Saudis had hoped that by keeping supply going when demand was declining worldwide and driving the price of oil down, that they could drive U.S. frackers out of business. But U.S. frackers are basing their profitability on technology. And what's happened is that they've cut costs and improved their technology so that they can still compete with the low and make profits on the low price of oil, right? So the Saudis are losing. The Saudis are losing the global battle to control the price of oil. And the point is that, you know, when you talk about the Saudis and frackers in Russia here, yes, we're talking about supply of oil. And that affects the long-term price of oil. But in the short run, it's the speculators who drive it up or down. And the speculators are investing in oil commodity futures. It's a financial security, and they are buying and trading those securities. And the value of the dollar influences that buying and trading. So as the dollar rises, oil prices decline. All right. And we got West Texas crude and Brent crude, the European benchmarks and the U.S. benchmarks, now at about $45 a barrel. This is probably going to drift to 40. Of course, that's going to have really some further negative impact on countries that are highly dependent on the price of oil. We'll talk about that shortly. Okay. Dollar rising, long-term rates rising, short-term rates starting to rise, oil prices decline. This is all a consequence of the expectation that the U.S. is going to launch some very significant fiscal stimulus focused on infrastructure, and that will drive the prices up in the U.S., whereas the Fed for 8 years could not drive goods and service prices up by pumping $15 trillion into the U.S. economy. We've talked about that before. Real investment, infrastructure investment, will do so. That's the bet, at least, that we're going to see price rises next year above 2% in the U.S., and that's driving the value of the dollar in long-term rates. And both rates... you know, it's not just the dollar driving rates. The rising rates drive the dollar. It's a mutual feedback effect here. Okay, and we already have the dollar at a 13.5-year high, at a peak. Yes, the dollar is rising rapidly, rapidly, just before the election and ever since the election. It's almost unprecedented, the rate of increase in the value of the dollar. This has consequences, both for U.S. economy and for the global economy, right? The question then becomes, will the increase in interest rates following the dollar, both long-term and short-term, will they economically negate Trump's infrastructure fiscal stimulus? That's a question. You know, I mean, the economy is going to grow some because of the infrastructure spending. It's kind of like, and Obama, when he came into office in 2009, he had this stimulus bill, fiscal stimulus bill, $787 billion, remember? $300 billion in tax cuts, and most of that went to corporations and investors and small businesses. He agreed to take out the consumer tax cuts out of that. And we had about $300 billion in infrastructure spending. But it didn't have a big effect, and we had about $100 billion infrastructure spending. Long-term projects had very little effect on jobs, and we had about $300 billion. I'm talking about the Obama recovery program, 2009, $300 billion in payments to the states, and the states were supposed to do the hiring. See, but they never did. The states sat on it too, and corporations sat on the $300 billion, a lot of it, in tax cuts, and it didn't stimulate the economy very much. You know, that was the problem. Then in 2000, when that initial bill kind of ran its course, under Obama in 9 and 10. The economy still wasn't doing very well in 2010. And Obama agreed to pass another $855 billion, $805 billion of which was in corporate tax cuts. $805 billion. $50 billion was to extend unemployment insurance benefits, which were necessary because the long-term unemployment was quite severe. So, you know, $300 billion in tax cuts when he first comes in office in 2009, and then starting in 2010-11, another $800 billion in tax cuts, mostly always, you know, corporate investor small business tax cuts, $800 billion. That included $450 billion, that $800 billion, $450 billion of extending of the Bush tax cuts of the early 2000s, 2001, 3, 4, 5. Which was about $3.4 trillion, 80% of which went to businesses and corporations and investors. So Bush passes, $3.4 trillion, and then Obama comes in. First thing he does is $300 billion. Then he does another $800 billion. And then in 2012-13, he agrees in that so-called fiscal cliff deal, he agrees to pass... extend the Bush tax cuts for another 10 years at the cost of $5 trillion. So add it up, you know, $3.4 trillion, 80% of which go to businesses, investors, $300 billion, roughly the same, $800 billion in 2010, and then $5 trillion for the next decade. So you got about $9 to $10 trillion in business tax and investor tax cuts since 2001. Almost $10 trillion. And, you know, all these bills were called job-creating, this and that job-creating, et cetera, right? They always frame these tax cuts in terms of job creation. But look at the record. You know, that's the proof whether tax cuts, these tax cuts, the way they're structured, create jobs. No, they don't. We've had a massive loss of jobs in manufacturing and in construction. Right? We've had some creation of jobs in the service sector. Right, but the service jobs have been low paid and oftentimes contingent, part-time temp, independent contractor and gig, et cetera. You know, so the job creation has been paltry and poor. 5 million people have left the labor force, that they don't talk about. So we've got this big lie that tax cuts create jobs. Maybe if the tax cuts were structured in such a way where, okay, company, you can get a 7 or 10% investment tax credit after you create the jobs and after you do the investment. No, and only in the U.S. No, our tax structure, the way it works is you get these tax cuts whether you do the investment or not. And whether you create jobs or not, rather, and whether you do create those jobs in the U.S. or abroad, you see. Tax cuts to move jobs offshore. That's what we've gotten, this tax structure. Okay. All right. So the question, again, to repeat, is will the interest rates, right, negate the Trump infrastructure spending? In other words, will higher interest rates slow down the economy more than infrastructure will stimulate the economy? That depends on a couple things. One, and that depends on how sensitive investment is to interest rate hikes. I believe, and I've talked about it in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, that the relationship between interest rates and investment, or what's economists sometimes call the elasticity effect of investment to rates, has declined in response to reducing rates, but has accelerated, become more sensitive to an increase in rates, so that the rise in rates, I think, is going to dampen investment in a lot of areas significantly, just as the reduction in the rates did not do that. Okay, so if that's true, we will see outside of infrastructure spending, we will see a slowing of investment in the U.S. economy. Question is, will that slowdown in investment real investment, not financial, elsewhere in the economy be worse than the stimulus of the investment in the infrastructure? We'll see whether that's true. A lot will depend upon whether that infrastructure spending is capital intensive or labor intensive, and how long the projects are. I suspect that the infrastructure spending will be very capital intensive. We'll create jobs in construction, but we will lose jobs elsewhere. The question is, what's going to be the net effect here? Interest rates, for example, will certainly slow residential housing and commercial property construction. But will that decline in that kind of construction be offset by infrastructure fiscal stimulus? Well, we'll see, right? We'll see whether the net effect on jobs is going to be significant or not. You know, if it's capital-intensive infrastructure spending, it's not going to be significant. If it's long-term projects, it's going to take a while, right, from this infrastructure. But the rising rates will have a more immediate negative effect on stimulus here and the economy, particularly housing and commercial property, which is in the doldrums as well. Okay, and the net job effect is going to be interesting to see. But I don't think it'll be significant. Okay, let's move on here, talking about further global economic effects of the Trump new economic Trumponomics, whatever you want to call it, right? We've talked about oil prices, rising dollar, rising long-term, and now short-term rates. And infrastructure stimulus versus investment depression because of rising rates. What is the effect on U.S. exports? What economists call net exports. Net exports is the difference between exports and imports, right? When the U.S. calculates gross domestic product, you know, it says, well, what's the value of our exports? What's the dollar value of all the exports we made in a given year? And what's the dollar value of all the imports that come into the U.S.? And we subtract the imports from the exports value, and that gets us net exports. If the subtraction comes up with a negative number, right, if imports, the value of imports are greater than the value of exports, net exports are a negative, and that's subtracted from gross domestic product from the U.S., in the U.S. Okay. We continually run here a negative net exports. In other words, our imports are greater than our exports. Now, the rising dollar reduces our exports. U.S. companies exporting become less competitive, and therefore they lose out contracts to more competitive, lower price competitive here, players elsewhere in the world. So our exports decline because of a rising dollar. At the same time, because the dollar rises, we have import costs also rise. If you're importing things, imports will rise in cost. All right, so net exports, U.S. net exports, sum up, will decline. That has a big effect on manufacturing because a lot of our exports are manufacturing exports. Right, so manufacturing is barely growing. You know, it's been bobbling up and down between negative and stagnant and barely above, so forth, already. That's because this trend of long-term rise in the dollar and long-term rates has been steadily growing even before the election. Right? Now it's accelerating. So we're going to see a continued acceleration of the value of the dollar rising and rates rising, and that's going to depress manufacturing exports and manufacturing in general. That will mean losses of jobs in manufacturing. Okay? We're already beginning to see it in some places. All right? So we have to consider that loss of jobs in manufacturing alongside, what is going to be the net effect on jobs from rates rising versus infrastructure stimulus in the U.S., right? And the timing of this is important, right? Rising rates and declining exports, right, are happening now, and will occur fairly rapidly. The job creation from infrastructure spending is going to be long term to happen, so we may find ourselves losing jobs in manufacturing here because of declining exports, because of rising dollar, a lot sooner than we realize job gains from infrastructure spending. Right? The net result, will not be immediate, and we could have more of a negative effect short term rather than long term. And of course, rising rates means housing and commercial property construction also slows. And as that slows, there will be a decline in jobs there. So we can expect manufacturing and housing to decline as a contributor to GDP, and employment in those two sectors to decline, right? Which means the only place you're going to get jobs apart from infrastructure, which will take a while, is service. And, of course, that means more part-time temp contingent jobs. Looking at the rising dollar and rising rates effects on Europe, Japan, emerging markets, China, and so forth, what can we expect here? First of all, Europe. Rising rates, long-term rates, we're talking about bond rates, right? U.S. bonds, corporate bonds, U.S. bonds. If you look at bonds in Europe, they're offered at a much lower rate than in the U.S. In other words, they're almost zero. In some cases, they were negative rates. And if you've got U.S. Treasury bonds, 30-year Treasury bonds at 3%, and you've got European government bonds at less than 1%, you've got more than the 2% spread between the two. Right, and so where are investors going to invest? When they invest in bonds, are they going to invest with a rate that's virtually zero in Europe, or are they going to invest in a 3% rate in the U.S.? No, they're going to invest in the U.S. That means money capital is going to flow out of Europe, and it is already to the U.S. Right? If money capital flows out, that means there's going to be less investment, less real investment in Europe. That's going to slow Europe's economy. Now, the money is going to flow out of, is flowing out of Europe to the U.S., not only to buy U.S. Treasury bonds, but also to invest in the U.S. stock market, which is rising relatively faster, in expectation of the infrastructure boom. You see, a lot of this is driven ultimately, fundamentally, by expectations of the so-called shift from relying just on monetary policy, which wasn't producing any real investment in the U.S. for 8 years, now to fiscal stimulus through infrastructure in the U.S. The U.S. is going to make that leap. Elsewhere, fiscal stimulus has been austerity in Europe and Japan and so forth. They won't spend. The government won't spend. They rely totally on the central banks because the bankers drive the whole policy in the capitalist, well, not the whole, but virtually in all these capitalist countries. It's a reflection of the financialization, the bankers getting control of government and government policy. They love the free money, and they don't want to get off of the free money, no matter what it means for the economy. And fiscal policy has been on a back burner everywhere for 8 years. Well, now Trump's breaking that, you see. And Trump is breaking the mold in the how the mold gets restructured is a big question mark. But in the U.S., it's resulting in expectations of, there's new ways to make new profits here on infrastructure. So it's boosting the economy. But the rest of the world is dragging their heels. The rest of the, Europe and advanced economies So money's going to flow into U.S. stocks and bonds out of Europe, and that's not good for Europe. Now, what that means is the European Central Bank, where they're still focusing on monetary policy, will probably lower QE even more, pump up QE, rather, even more, quantitative easing, pump money into the economy, to try to drive their currency down, right, to compete for exports. Europe's more dependent on exports. Some countries like Germany, 50% of GDP is exports. So they're going to drive the euro down through this QE stuff, right? Even more. Even though, you know, the U.S. is raising its rates, which drives down the currency of Europe as the U.S. currency rises, that's not going to be enough for them because they're going to have more capital outflow and they're going to have to try to compete by continuing their monetary policy, which is a failure. But that's what they're going to do, right? They'll follow up with more monetary policy stimulus that doesn't work and not with infrastructure spending. Well, why not? Why doesn't Europe go with fiscal infrastructure expenditures? Well, because the Germans and their central bankers have a stranglehold on Europe and European policy. They're driving it, and the bankers run the show in Germany, and they want they in these pan-European institutions, European Commission, and so forth. As I showed, by the way, quite clearly, I think, in my most recent book called Looting Greece, an Emerging New Financial Imperialism, which makes the argument that Germany and its northern colleagues, northern EU, Eurozone colleagues, really run the show there, and they are just financially bleeding the periphery. And, you know, the latest, of course, development there is what's going on in Italy, right? And the crisis in banks in Italy. Anyway, this European situation, in other words, the main factor here is rising U.S. currency, which is raising U.S. bond rates and sucking money capital out of Europe to the U.S. because of the spread. And that is going to you know, reduce real investment in Europe, so Europe will respond with more QE. The situation in Europe is you know, as I said, why aren't they doing the shift to infrastructure fiscal spending? Well, it's not only because of Germany's stranglehold, German bankers, but you know, you have a lot of political uncertainty there in Europe right now. We're going to have a referendum here in Italy, and it's going to fail. Post, you know, we had Brexit, we had the Trump election. Well, I think the same phenomenon is going to happen in Italy, where the political elite is trying to give itself more political power, and I think the referendum will result in the Italian people saying no, and that will provoke a crisis of government in Italy, probably a fall of the government, and they'll have to have new elections, and then the five-star movement may move in there when they have new elections in 2017. Now, there's a new elections everywhere in Europe. In France, in April, May, they're going to have final elections and runoffs, and I think the National Front may repeat Trump's victory and the Brexit victory here. That will send shockwaves everywhere and probably will accelerate the unraveling of the Eurozone, because that's one of the main policies. Like Trump, they are very critical of free trade within the Eurozone and everywhere else. So that will have a big effect there. In that, and then Germany has its elections in August, September of next year. And while it looks now that Merkel is, you know, still firmly in control, who knows? After a cataclysmic shock of France and maybe a French exit from the Eurozone and Italy and so forth, who knows what will happen with Germany. And then there are outliers where, you know, the far right has almost won an election there, and they probably were manipulated in Austria from taking office. and Netherlands, a strong, Trump-like, National Front-like movement there, Freedom Party, I think it's called. So with all that, these elections and uncertainty, there's not going to be any shift in policy to infrastructure spending or whatever in Europe until all that clouds over, or clears up, rather, right? So don't expect anything new out of Europe, right? And Europe, therefore, as the U.S. rushes ahead in infrastructure spending and the dollar rises and rates rise, Europe is going to be negatively affected. How about Japan? Right. Well, the same kind of a problem here. We got a big spread on bonds, and all things equal, you're not going to money will flow out of Japan, and it is already flowing abroad instead of being invested in Japan. Just this past week, Prime Minister Abe scurried to New York and then invited himself to talk to Trump. Right. And I think what we're going to see in Japan is a possibility, because they won't do normal fiscal spending, infrastructure spending. Well, they already did. Japan's interesting. Japan has done a lot of infrastructure spending, trillions of dollars in the last decade or so, and it hasn't really stimulated their economy. The big question is, how much will infrastructure spending stimulate the economy? It may not stimulate it very much. You know, it may be that there are what economists call low multiplier effects from fiscal spending, infrastructure spending. If so, it won't boost the economy that much and that many jobs. We will see. But if you look at Japan, it didn't do much for them either. Well, Japan's not exactly the U.S., but it's something to keep your eye on, I think. Okay, what I think could happen, Trump's foreign policy position has been that all these U.S. allies have to pay more for their own defense. The U.S. pays 70% of NATO and probably more than that of keeping the umbrella, the military umbrella there in Japan and South Korea. So the U.S. has been spending huge amounts for a long time to defend these countries, and these from what? Who knows? the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. What are we defending them against? Well, we're drumming up this thing about Russia, right? As the old Soviet Union, it's good for defense spending. Anyway, the U.S. is saying to Europe and Japan, you got to spend more. You got to for your own defense, right? You got to do it. We're not footing the bill forever. We'll see whether the old Republican establishment can back him off of that. Obama's already making his trip around Europe. Who knows what he's saying? And he's probably telling them that there are forces in the U.S. that aren't going to allow Trump to implement some of his views on NATO and so forth. That, oh, we'll stop him. Don't panic. We'll stop him. We'll see there. But as far as Japan is concerned, Japan and Abe want to remilitarize Japan. They want defense spending to increase. He can't get domestic fiscal spending going. Shinzo Abe, he might be able to get the defense spending going as a stimulus, because the monetary policy has not worked in Japan any more than it has worked in the U.S. or Europe. So the shift is to fiscal spending, and it may be just primarily a shift to defense spending, right? Which, by the way, was very much like Reagan. We'll talk about that, but Reagan moves off of monetary policy, de-emphasizes monetary policy, emphasizes fiscal policy. That was part of early neoliberalism, and defense spending was at the core of that. Okay, so we see similarities here with Trump, but I think you'll see a remilitarization of Japan as Japan gets the green light from the U.S. to go ahead and do that, because Japan can't do that without the U.S. approval. They're still a kind of a satrapy here of the United States since 1945. That's the interesting thing to watch with Japan, right? By the way, in all of these countries, Japan, China, whatever, what we're also seeing is sell-off of their holdings of U.S. treasuries. We'll talk about that shortly. China, okay? China, interesting responses here to the Trump economics. What? As the dollar rises, the Chinese currency, the yuan, declines, right? And the Chinese currency is fixed in a band to the U.S. between 6.2 to 6.8 something yuan, that's the currency, the yuan, to the U.S. dollar. So as the dollar rises, the yuan declines. Just as the dollar rises, the euro in Europe declines, or the yen in Japan declines elsewhere. Okay, so what we got here is as the dollar rises, the yuan, which was already depreciating, is now at the edge of its band. You know, and it can't, to go lower, it's got to break out of that band. China's got to announce an extension of that ban, or no longer peg it to the dollar. All right. More devaluation of the yuan, however, means more capital flight. You know, investors don't want to hold the currency that's collapsing in value or declining in value. It means they're losing paper profits, right? So what do they do? They take that currency and they buy another currency with it. In this case, they buy dollars. Everybody wants to buy dollars if their currency is devaluating. By the way, that effect, which is initially driven from rising dollar and rising U.S. interest rates, exacerbates the rise in the dollar in rates. Because if I'm selling my my Argentine pesos, right, I'm increasing the supply of pesos, which reduces the price of pesos, the exchange rate, but it also pushes up, because I'm increasing demand for dollars, it pushes up the value of the dollar, right? So devaluations in these other currencies, because the dollar is rising, result in further pressure to raise the dollar. And if dollar is rising, then all these investors and, you know, people who made all this money in China, right, they want to move their money out. They don't want to hold it in a currency, the yuan, that's declining or more likely to decline. They want to move it out. That's called capital flight. Now, China has expended a lot of resources in order to stem this capital flight. And by stemming it, particularly after when the Chinese stock market bubble burst, right, a lot of money floating around, investors wanted to move it out, right, and China put controls on it and allowed that money from the China stock bubble burst to move back into housing and construction. And that just relit the housing bubble in China for the third time. Well, now China has been taking moves to dampen the housing bubble again. Where is that money going to go? Well, with the declining pressure on the yuan, more pressure for capital flight, right? The problem in China is that for at least 5 years now, we have this massive, massive liquidity injection that's caused these bubbles and rotating bubbles, you know, in housing. Local housing construction, in the stock market, in what's called asset management products and so forth. You know, it's just rotating bubbles. If you're going to keep all that liquidity in the economy, you're going to have bubbles created somewhere, and if you don't let it out, you know, it's going to create bubbles somewhere. So China is stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? But if China slowly devaluates, that's going to set off a currency war, right? Further, because the rising dollar already has that effect. With with treasuries rising and interest rates rising, right, now there's a sell-off here of U.S. treasuries by China, Japan, and all the other countries of the world, right? A big sell-off. If you're selling treasuries, you're reducing the price of treasuries, but you are further driving up the rate of treasuries, the interest rate. So this is just another force here, raising U.S. long-term rates that the Fed has no control over, right? How significant is this? Well, in September alone, a record $77 billion in bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds, were sold. The highest volume since 1978 when this stuff was began tracking, right? And a lot of it, 40, 45, 46 billion, was sold by holdings by central banks. You know, Bank of China, Bank of Japan, so on. They're selling these treasuries. Well, if they're selling treasuries, they're not going to buy treasuries, right? And if you're running infrastructure spending and deficits, the Fed's going to have to issue more treasuries. But if people are selling treasuries and not buying them, then the Fed has to raise its interest rates even more in order to entice people to buy treasuries. And that's raising the total debt, because the cost of financing debt's going to rise significantly. Okay. Emerging markets, Latin America, et cetera. Currency collapse already underway, rapidly. Capital flight, again, flowing out of these emerging markets. Less investment going in, more capital flight going out. That means less available money capital for investment. Less investment means slowing their economies, means unemployment will rise and is rising in those economies, right? Now, what do these economies do in response? Well, what they can do is raise their domestic interest rates to slow the capital flight, but that slows down their economies even more. Also, when their currencies collapse, you know, that means domestic inflation is going to rise as a result of import prices rising significantly. And in many of these economies, you know, imports constitute a major, major part of their total consumption. So if your currency declines, the importing of goods, both business and consumer goods, rise in price. So inflation. So you've got more unemployment amidst more inflation going on. This is exacerbated even further by oil-dependent economies, who, as I said before, oil price declines, who are totally dependent on government spending based on the price of oil. You know, countries like Venezuela, Nigeria, and so forth. They're even going to be worse off because of this. Now, a further problem here, in Latin America, is that businesses, private sector businesses, have borrowed a huge amount of debt, largely from offshore banks, advanced economies banks. Huge amount. How much? $25 trillion in the last 5 years. $25 trillion of private debt, corporate debt in the emerging markets. These are figures from Bank of International Settlements and the IMF statistics. And a lot of this debt is in dollars. In other words, it's dollarized corporate debt and therefore must be repaid in dollars, service, you know, the principal and interest. But if your economy is declining and global trade is slowing everywhere, where are you going to earn the dollars to pay this $25 trillion in debt? Right? And if the rates rise, then you can't borrow money to stimulate, to expand, and global trade is slowing down. Emerging markets are in a deep doo-doo, particularly Latin America. Now, as Latin America and emerging markets decline, right, and their currencies decline, multinational U.S. corporations who are there in these economies are experiencing a profit decline. In other words, if they keep their profits in the local currency and the currency is declining, they're losing money. So they're going to start repatriating these profits back to the U.S. How much is offshore, held in offshore multinationals and investors in dollars? $2.5 trillion. $2.5 trillion, right? That's why we're going to see these corporate tax cuts, which are coming very fast in the U.S., at the center of which is going to be this repatriation proposal to bring back the taxes, the money offshore, repatriated the $2.5 trillion, according to independent research firm Capital Economics, right? Repatriated $2.5 trillion and pay 10% tax instead of 35% corporate tax. A big boondoggle for multinational corporations like Apple and IBM and so forth. Apple, by the way, has $200 billion, 90% of all its cash held overseas, right? Tech companies, pharma companies, banks, so forth. Microsoft, more than $100 billion. GE, $100 billion. IBM, $65 billion. drug company Pfizer, $80 billion. They're holding it all offshore and not paying taxes on it, and trying to blackmail the U.S. government, well, we'll pay some of it if you let us bring it back at a lower rate. Well, they did that in 2005. You know, there was like $700 billion held offshore then by these companies, and they convinced the Bush Congress to bring it back and pay 5.25%, which they did. And they said, oh, we'll create jobs, which they didn't. They used it to buy up mergers and acquisitions and pay back stock and so on and so forth, right? And they're doing it again. They're doing it again, and Democrats as well as Republicans are going to let them do it, right? And they say, oh, you know, because the U.S. corporate tax rate globally is the highest in the world, 35%. Not true. With all the loopholes, U.S. large multinational companies pay 12.2% in tax, U.S. tax, given all the loopholes. Their payments to state and local governments, corporate taxes, about 3%. You know, they're already paying only 15% at most. Okay. The Trump bill proposes three tax brackets of 12%, 25%, and 33% instead of the 39.6%, right? That's the individual personal income tax. The rich will get from the Trump tax bill $120,000, the wealthiest 1%, and the wealthiest 1% will get $700,000 reduction in their taxes. That's the Trump tax bill. Okay, we'll talk some more about this next week when we keep up our efforts to follow the Trump assignments here and what these policies begin to look like. But that's what it looks like globally. That's the global effects already of the Trump policies.